In this part of Focus 580, we'll be looking at the issue of income inequality here in America, particularly when we compare black Americans with other Americans. It seems to be the case that in recent years, to some extent, inequality has eased, perhaps because at least until fairly recently, the economy was doing pretty well. But in spite of that, income inequality continues to exist. And we'll be talking this morning with a guest who has done a lot of writing and research in the area. His name is James Stewart. He is professor of labor studies and industrial relations, as well as African and African-American studies at Penn State. He has served as Penn State's director of Penn State's Black Studies program. He also served as vice chair of the National Council for Black Studies and has been working and writing in this area for some time. He's contributed to a number of books and written a number of papers on a variety of issues, including this one. He's here visiting the campus and talked on this topic yesterday, and we're pleased to have him spend a little time with us here this morning. Questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number, and we will pay for the call, 800-222-9455. Another way of doing it, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. At any point, you're welcome to join us. Questions are, we just ask people to try and be brief just so we can keep things moving along, but anyone's welcome to call. Well, thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure to be here.
Can we just maybe talk a little bit in the beginning about where we are now, and can you say some things about how black Americans are doing compared to other Americans, particularly white Americans, economically speaking?
Well, I think there's good news and bad news. I think, as you pointed out, during the unprecedented expansion, African Americans and Latinos did very, very well, that the rates of unemployment fell faster than they did for white Americans. Income was rising fairly rapidly. But what we're seeing in the first stages of this new recession is a dramatic decline in employment, that over the last month, the unemployment rate for African Americans jumped by 1%. And a similar magnitude of drop for Latinos as well. And this follows the same pattern that we have seen in previous recessions, where people of color, particularly African Americans and Latinos, are hit disproportionately with layoffs because they've been the last hired, and of course they're the first laid off. So we're likely to see this erosion of some of these gains that we've seen over the early 1990s. At the same time, people who have college degrees are doing much better than people that don't. So there's still a large segment of the African-American population that has not benefited very much from the expansion of the 1990s. So you have the good news for the middle class and not so good news for the lower class.
In spite of recent improvements, that is the improvements that took place before the recent retrenchment, this inequality, though, has been very persistent. How does one account for that? When you ask people why, is there some sort of consensus of factors that people would say, well, it is in large part these things?
Well, there's, of course, disagreement about the relative strength of different factors, but there are a lot of factors that people point to. One is the fact that there's continuing differences in the quality of education received by African Americans that are educated in public schools, primarily in inner cities, that translates into lower earnings. There's clearly problems related to the dropout rates in schools and the higher rates of incarceration and engagement with the criminal justice system that also works against long-run stability in communities. A lack of public investment in communities that reduces the access to important experiences that one might have that contribute to further success down the road. The resurgence of segregation, residential segregation, that mm-hmm. segregation has increased significantly and is at levels that are comparable to what existed before the civil rights movement started in many cities. The problems associated with being reared in single-parent households limits the opportunities for many of the, some people would argue that the cutbacks in support for affirmative action have limited opportunities. So there are a whole plethora of factors, and trying to sort out what's most important and what is relatively unimportant to the changes that we see is a very, very difficult task.
Mm-hmm. Well, when one gets around then to asking questions about how it is one might address and reduce that inequality, and I know academics and people who study economics and people in politics, of course, I'm sure talk about these sorts of things all the time. There are some things that seem to be more likely to have some effect and some things that seem to be less likely to have an effect. And it seems that in spite of the fact that we'd have to recognize that discrimination is a problem, it doesn't those strategies that say, well, what we're going to do is we're going to work towards a colorblind society. We're going to say everybody's the same. There's equality of opportunity, and there's no reason why everybody can't make it. And, you know, that sort of boilerplate that we like to use, that, in fact, that doesn't seem to help.
Well, it doesn't, although it obviously is a very attractive sort of metaphor that everybody wants to talk about a colorblind society. And in fact, if you go back to the early 1960s when Lyndon Johnson talked about the fact that we wanted to move toward that, but he recognized that if you have two people at the starting line in a race and one person is shackled and another person is free, then it's hard to say that we're in a situation where there's going to be equal opportunities and equal results. So you have to do something to address the past grievances before you can actually move toward this colorblind example. And I think a lot of people have sort of latched on to this colorblind example, and they've tried to take the rhetoric of leaders like Martin Luther King out of context, because Martin Luther King also said that certainly we want to move to that, but we've got to do some things first to make sure that everyone has equal opportunity to benefit from the economic growth and prosperity before we can talk about colorblindness. There appear to be there tends to be a tendency when economic conditions are bad for there to be a sort of a growing clannishness, that people will become much more concerned about those with whom they identify most closely. Mm-hmm. And that, again, works against the idea of treating everyone as part of one's community or constituency. And I think we're going to see some of that occurring as the recession persists. A lot of people who, particularly even African-Americans who talk about colorblindness, are people that have been successful. So once you're successful, colorblindness is a good idea. But for those who have not had the opportunity to interact with individuals from different backgrounds and don't have the same socialization, interacting in a way which demonstrates mutual respect, dignity, and understanding of the culture is a very, very difficult process.
Mm. Well, if adopting that kind of rhetoric really doesn't help, then what does?
Well, I think that a lot of my research, as you indicate, I look at an income inequality, but I also look at wealth inequality. And one of the biggest driving forces that limits the extent to which we can move toward equality of opportunity is tremendous wealth gaps between white Americans and African Americans. The average African American family has wealth of about $10,000. The average white American family has about $84,000. So that provides significantly more opportunities to, say, invest in education, invest in other sorts of resources. And so the reparations movement that, of course, has gained increasing visibility and become very controversial over the last few years isn't an issue that's tried to get at the issue of wealth inequalities. So, and I firmly believe, based upon the research that I've done and looking at what other people have done, that that's really one of the most significant ways in which we can talk about trying to, if you will, level the playing field so that as we move into a new economy that's driven by information technology, services, and so forth, that everybody will have a chance to benefit. And I'm not talking about a reparations process that gives individuals payments. It's really simply investments in social capital, social infrastructure, the schools, and so forth that would eliminate some of the gaps that can't be addressed through the existing channels. As an example, public schools simply don't have the resources because the property tax bases have eroded so that they can't really invest in improving the schools to make them comparable to what you might see in a suburban district.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should talk a little bit about the distinction between wealth and income It's one that might, unless one's an economist, one might elude you a little bit. I guess that some people might see that as being the same, or at least that those two things are inextricably connected. That is, if you don't have income, you can't build wealth.
Well, generally speaking, that's true. That the classic way in which you build wealth is, of course, to save something from your disposable income, and you accumulate that over time, and that then becomes sort of an asset that you can tap into to use to undertake projects or expenditures that you might not otherwise be able to do out of your normal income. And the problem is that there's also other ways of getting wealth, and that is that you can inherit wealth. And so, in fact, the old millionaires, not the sort of new millionaires that have been created during the information technology boom, so really a lot of that is inherited wealth. So they really didn't necessarily earn it. It was simply that their predecessors were able to invest and to gain returns from those investments that they were able to pass on to subsequent generations. And that's then part of the problem that African Americans experience, that you haven't had that sort of wealth creation, that passing on from generation to generation, that it gives you the flexibility to take advantage of new opportunities in the way that you could if you did have access to that wealth. Mm-hmm.
For a lot of people, their most significant asset is going to be their home. And maybe we could come back for a moment to the issue of housing. And I know this is something that in fact, you've written about. And I think that it's interesting you pointed out the fact that when one asks this question about why is there persistent inequality, the resurgence of segregation is a factor one has to point to. And I think the reason it's important is that it seems that from time to time, discrimination in housing has been something that's been an issue that's gotten a lot of attention. But it seems that it waxes and wanes in being something that we pay attention to. And it seems to be really very important, and that perhaps always has been important, in spite of the fact that sometimes we've really concentrated on that and then we've looked at other kinds of discrimination. But it seems to be really a key factor in this whole issue of wealth building.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I think that we're starting to see a resurgence of interest in looking at patterns of discrimination in housing, and issues like mortgage lending, redlining in particular, steering, and so forth, because as you correctly point out, a lot of people have most of their financial wealth tied up in their residence. And disproportionately, African Americans tend to be renters more likely than owners. And African Americans tend to hold whatever wealth they have typically either in homes or in automobiles. Whereas if you look at the portfolios of white Americans, particularly middle class, there's a disproportionate amount of wealth held in the form of financial assets, stocks and bonds, compared to African Americans. So there's differences in the way in which wealth is held. And the discrimination in the housing markets that we were talking about will result in a lot of different factors, like the undervaluation of properties that are in neighborhoods that are predominantly minority, so that you don't have as much capital value as you might in another community. The inability to move from the status of being a renter to owner, and an inability to build up equity that you can then tap into through home equity loans and so forth.
Mm. Just to pick up on the issue of investment and the fact as you suggest, that it's much more common among white Americans than it is black Americans. Is that, again, it's an issue of the ability to save so that you can then have the money to invest? Or does it also have something to do with simple familiarity with the process and it being something that, you know, maybe either people you know do, or your family does, or your family did, and it's just something that you need to in some way be introduced to?
Well, it's certainly an issue of familiarity and education, and a lot of it is also occupational structure, that most Americans' holdings in the stock market are in the form of retirement pensions. And so if you work in an establishment where you have the option of investing in 401ks and so forth, then typically you'll get some educational materials that'll help you to understand that. But if you don't work in that type of occupation, you're going to have less access to that type of information. And in a lot of communities of people of color, there's been a tendency to be very distrustful of new form, what are perceived at least as new forms of investment that don't seem to be as secure as, say, a traditional savings account. So there has been a traditional reluctance to do something other than put your money into a traditional savings account. And as a result of that, you're obviously losing potential gains because you get greater returns, at least until recently, in the stock market and in other types of assets. So there's clearly a need for a major educational campaign. But as you also point out, if you don't have the money to invest, then you still, even having the information isn't going to help you a lot.
Yeah. Going press back to for a moment to the issue of discrimination in housing, it is illegal. And there are, from time to time, I think, efforts to get at the issue that way. How might we better address just the simple issue of the issue of resources are one thing, but the issue of plain and simple, straightforward discrimination, redlining, and so forth, that's another. How do we get at that?
Well, the contemporary strategy that's used to try to monitor that is called auditing. And what's done is, as example, if you take a couple with similar characteristics other than their racial identity, and you send them to the same real estate broker, and you can find out whether or not they're steered differently toward different housing. Mm-hmm. And you can do the same thing with mortgage applications, that you can create applications that look the same except for the racial identity of individuals. And what those audit studies have shown is that there's significant, probably about 25% of the cases in these studies do experience some sort of discrimination. And this sort of audit technique has become important for looking at other types of discrimination as well. There have been studies that look at what happens when you go to automobile dealerships in terms of the terms that one gets in terms of interest rates and so forth. And you see that same sort of phenomenon. So there's clearly discrimination going on, and it's much more subtle than it used to be, and that's why we've had to develop new techniques to try to get at it.
Yeah. Are we giving it to the level of attention that it deserves?
I don't think that we are. I think that in the last decade or so, there's been the perception that some of the traditional forms of discrimination have disappeared, that there's more opportunities for everyone if they'll just work hard. You see a lot of that rhetoric, and that's led to reductions in the aggressiveness of enforcement of a lot of the anti-discrimination legislation. I think what we've also seen, though, are increases in class action suits that are filed by particularly in employment discrimination cases, because there were some changes in the 1994 laws that allows aggrieved employees to file class action suits. And those have been, I think, very visible in some cases. Large companies like Coca-Cola, Merrill Lynch, and so forth have been the targets of those suits, and there have been large settlements that have resulted from that. So these lawsuits have become sort of an alternative to a regular enforcement mechanism, which I guess has both its pros and cons.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the very point that I was thinking of, whether in fact that if we're not giving it the attention that we should, that is the result of a mindset that says, oh, well, this is not really a problem anymore. Yes, it was a problem in the past, but it's not a problem now.
And I think that clearly has been sort of the social mindset. And there hasn't been a sort of a vehicle to talk about these patterns of continuing discrimination. Not as easy or as visible, say, as direct denial of a case. And in the Pittsburgh area, as an example, there was a situation recently where a couple contracted to have their house painted, and the painting crew showed up and it was all black, and they said, "No, we're not going to allow you to paint our house." And so the contractor went back to their employer, and the owners called and wanted another crew to come. So the owner of the company filed a suit against the couple for breach of contract, and they wound up winning. And And that was, of course, a very visible case. You can see, and obviously almost nobody disagreed with the fact that the discrimination had occurred in that case. But in cases where it's much more subtle, where you can't really put your hands on it, it's much harder for people to understand that it's not simply the traditional sort of flexibility that one has in making decisions about who you're going to do business with or who you're going to admit to an institution of higher education or to offer a job to.
We're at our midpoint here. Let me just again introduce our guest. We're speaking with James Stewart. He is a professor of labor studies and industrial relations and African and African-American studies at Penn State, and has written a lot on this very subject here and others that we're talking about in the issue of income inequality in America and what might be done about it. He's visiting the campus, talked about some of his work yesterday, and we're glad to have him here on the program this morning. Questions are certainly welcome if you would like to give us a call, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Just to return to a subject you talked a little bit about when I asked that question, how one could go about addressing inequality, and that there are some things that we like to think might help that probably don't, and others that where there's more evidence that they would make a difference. And you use the term reparations, which, as you suggest, as you point out, is something that there's conversation going on about it now. It's very controversial, and perhaps different people will mean different things by that term. Some people do indeed talk about direct payments, and others talk about different sorts of strategies, as that is, for example, making money available so people can go to college. You talk about perhaps also investing in important infrastructure in communities that really need it, schools, for example. How I'm just wondering what your sense of this whole conversation is now, and is it something that people really can talk and do talk seriously about, give thought, careful thought to, or that it tends to be more polarized and kind of a loud discussion and a case where there's lots of heat but not much light?
Well, I actually think both of those are happening. I think that there's a lot of serious discussion going on. There are a couple of groups that are in the process of developing lawsuits to try and bring the issue to the court system. But there's also a lot of opposition, and a lot of the opposition stems from, as you correctly point out, differences in understanding about what's meant and what the intention is and what the underlying logic of reparations is. That I think some people who oppose reparations do so because they perceive that this is asking individuals to pay for something that someone's ancestors might have done that they had no part in and don't agree with. Whereas I think some of the adherents to the philosophy of reparations is arguing that it's really not asking individuals to pay, it's asking the government, because the government was implicated in the institution of slavery and its aftermath, and simply following the precedents that have been established, say, in terms of the Japanese and the Jews in Germany. It's asking the government, not individuals, to pay. I think that as you pointed out, some people want to make individual payments. I don't think that's the same, because essentially the reparations philosophy that I endorse is one that looks at the damage to the entire communities and not saying that one individual ought to benefit. As example, I'm middle class, and it would be difficult for me to claim that I would be in a different situation if my parents had, or my grandparents and great grandparents had not been enslaved. Whereas others might be able to make such a claim. So we can't sort that out on an individual basis.
We have a caller to join the conversation on cell phone. We'll get them right here on line number one. Hello.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm glad that you're trying to be careful about this, because just my instinctive reaction to reparations is very, very, very negative, and I'll tell you why. most of my family wasn't even in the United States until long after the Civil War. And so I don't see really why I should feel any particular personal guilt over what happened. We didn't have anything to do with it. And I think you're going to find that an awful lot of people fall in that exact camp. And that doesn't, I mean, you know, if there's sort of this, I mean, if there's kind of a direct connection. Now, you're talking more about investment in community, and I have no problem with that. In fact, I think that's probably the best way to solve the issue. I guess maybe the term reparations bothers me. I don't know. I mean, that's arguing about words, and maybe that's not such a great idea. But I remember a number of arguments when I was in college with people, you know, wanting direct payments and this and that. And I won't do it. But the other point I would make is the government, I mean, taxpayers are going to pay it. So it is going to be coming from individuals. Now, I don't think, like I said, I think if you're talking about investment in community, that's great, but why don't you talk about investment in community? And, you know, I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay. Well,
I appreciate the caller's comments, and I think it illustrates, again, the importance of talking about these issues very, very carefully. I think the caller is right that the taxpayers are going to pay, but remember, African Americans are taxpayers too, so we're going to be contributing. Those who are relatively well off enough to be paying taxes are also going to be contributing to whatever the fund is that might be used to make these investments. So it's not sort of a racially based sort of scheme. And I think the caller is right that he probably shouldn't feel guilt as an emotion related to this, but I think we have to recognize that many people have benefited from the legacies created by the institutions that we're talking about. So even if they had no direct involvement in operating them, putting them together, or simply endorsing them, they still benefit from them. And in that sense, then there's no sort of moral problem associated with sort of using the taxes as a vehicle to try to make people whole for the losses occurred through this process. But I think we need to have those type of discussions and be able to try and tease out what the major opposition is and find ways of coming to consensus about how to do this, because I think it's in everybody's interest.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you can certainly make the argument that the betterment of any American, no matter who he or she is, if what we're talking about is someone who will then be able to go out and work productively and support themselves and support their family and be a part of their community and pay taxes, that contributes to the betterment of everyone in the entire country. So indeed, if what we're talking about is an investment in American taxpayers paying, you can certainly make the argument that eventually it's going to pay back and should return, one can look at it in investment terms, should return more than the initial investment.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I'll use the Social Security system as an example, that one of the big problems that we're going to face in the next 20 years is the retirement of a lot of the baby boomers, of which I'm one. And what we don't have are enough, what we will not have are enough employed Americans that are making contributions to the Social Security system. So if we do put people who are not currently as productive as they could in the situation where they are contributing significantly to the growth of the economy and the generation of income and tax revenues, it's going to save us a lot of problems by 2015, 2020. And there's no question that if we can just look at the situation in a lot of inner cities and in some rural communities, that there's been significant underinvestment in the human potential. One of the areas that I study is industrial relations in countries other than the United States. And what I see in a number of developing countries, they've realized that in order to be successful in this new millennium, that you've got to put as many resources as possible into educating the current generations and making sure that they have the skills to function in this new type of global economy. And so in one sense, what I'm suggesting and why I take the approach of investing in communities and education is to try and make sure that all Americans do have the opportunity to contribute and so that our overall financial and economic health as a nation doesn't erode over as our demographics continue to change.
Mm-hmm. I was just going back to thinking about some of the comments of the listener. I think that some people, when we get into this discussion of reparations, would make the argument that taking it personally somehow misses the point. And that the basic point is that we'd have to acknowledge the fact that this country, the United States, was built in part, perhaps in significant part, by the forced labor of Africans who were brought here as slaves and then their descendants, and that that's something that their role in the building of the American economy is something we have to acknowledge. Though having done that, then, it seems to me maybe a little bit more difficult to then take to carry that forward and to say it's one thing to talk about what that meant in, you know, 1860, but then how do we think about what that meant then in 1960 or in the year 2001?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. There have been a number of studies that have been done that have tried to quantify what the contribution of enslaved Africans was to the growth of the U.S. economy and to translate that into current dollars. Mm-hmm. And the amounts that the researchers come up with are staggering. They're in some cases on the order of $1 trillion. And obviously there's not $1 trillion sitting around to compensate the descendants or anyone else. And it speaks to one of the problems is that what's happened to that income that was generated is that it's been consumed to a large extent. It's been invested in infrastructure in the country and so forth. So it's very difficult then to come up with a strategy of saying, well, how are we going to come up with a fund that's going to allow us to make these descendants whole? And there's no easy question because people are saying, okay, it's going to come out of my taxes, it's going to come out of my income, it's going to result in the loss of opportunities for my family. And they do get to that personal level. So at some level, I understand that personal concern, but at the same time, there clearly is an unpaid debt, social debt, that at the time of the ending of slavery, there were certain expectations made about trying to prepare the freedmen for full participation in society. That didn't happen. And a lot of people who support reparations are, I think, use the analogies of the Japanese internment, the compensation for Jews after because of the Holocaust and so forth, and ask why are those more acceptable in sort of a generic term than the issue of slavery, aside from the issue of the passage of time, that the sort of experiences that we're talking about are the same, so they should be subjected to the same principles in terms of acceptableness of compensation.
Hmm. I suppose too that when you look at the cases that you cite and look at the if we just look at it in terms of hard currency, the amount of money that people received, it was compared to what it is that they went through. A pittance, and that perhaps in those cases, acknowledging the wrong was the significant thing, and then they might make the same sort of a case and say, well, what would really be more important here is that we acknowledge the wrong done to Black Americans, and that then would be more significant. I suppose this is a way of dodging the whole issue, as saying, well, as long as we say we're sorry, then we don't have to worry about the writing any checks.
Interesting point. There's a relatively new book out about reparations that's entitled something like "When Sorry Is Not Enough," and which I think gets to part of that. And I think that's one of the issues that continues to drive the interest in reparations across the political spectrum in the Black community is that we've never had that sort of acknowledgement that this was really a system that was completely degrading in terms of humanity. And there were efforts during the waning years of the Clinton administration to get an apology for slavery. You couldn't get that out of the U.S. government. And there was an effort at the World Conference Against Racism in September to get that same sort of very forceful statement about slavery, mm-hmm. and the Western countries are resisting doing that. And until we get to that level of being able to do that, I don't think we're going to be able to talk very seriously about reparations either if we can't even get the apology.
We have about 10 minutes left here. Our guest, Professor James Stewart from Penn State. We have a caller here we'll get right to in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I came to the program a little late, so maybe you've covered a little bit of this, but it doesn't sound like it. And just preface it by saying I'm very much in favor of reparations. I think, you know, apologies are in order, many, many other things. But I guess I'd kind of like to go even beyond that. Our country was founded as a political entity by wealthy people who wrote a constitution that put property rights over the rights of the general welfare. And, you know, it's still the political economy is structured in favor of wealth. Not only is the tax system structured in favor of wealthy people and corporations, but also we've got a Federal Reserve Board that's unelected, it's appointed, and they, you know, pretty much try to work the economy so that it favors wealthy people. They're much more concerned about what bonds are doing than what the, you know, employment rate is. In fact, one of the reasons we've slid into this recession is because, you know, the Federal Reserve Board was clamping down on things to protect the bondholders, who are generally very, very wealthy people. You know, we're talking about the top 1%. And I think that, you know, along with reparations, there ought to be a restructuring of things so that, you know, people at the bottom of the economy get pulled up, you know, because not only is racism a drag on our culture and our economy, the degradation of poor in general is really holding us back.
Well, I think the caller is absolutely correct that if you look at the patterns of wealth inequality over the last 15 years, that wealth inequality as a whole has grown significantly in the United States and in several of the other industrialized countries. And generally speaking, when you have gross wealth inequality, it does become a drag on future economic growth, because at the lower end of the spectrum, you don't have individuals who have the income to consume goods that are produced. They don't have the wherewithal to be able to invest in their education, human capital, and so forth. So that clearly is a very, very serious problem. And if you look at the current debates about the stimulus package, I think you can see in clear relief that some of the proposals that the Republicans have put forth are clearly, as the caller suggests, designed to protect the interests of the well-off in terms of subsidies to corporations, like, as example, Enron, which was a clear case of gross financial mismanagement, and then you want to give them $1 million write-off, whereas there seems to be a lot of resistance to increasing unemployment benefits or facilitating the transition of individuals to be able to get retrained so that they can compete for some of the new jobs. In the United States, our system of preparing workers to contribute actively to the growth of the economy is much worse than in any other industrialized country in the world. And as the caller is suggesting, it reflects sort of a social sentiment in which individuals are presumed to be able to take care of themselves, whereas in other countries it's recognized that taking care of individuals contributes to the social well-being. And we do, and I agree with you, that we do need a broader sort of transformation discussion going on at the same time that we talk about the situation of African Americans.
Yeah, you alluded to the stimulus package that they're talking about, the Republicans are talking about, as if that's going to help create jobs, but I think you well know that, you know, people who run corporations are not going to create jobs if they don't think that anybody's going to be buying their product and services. So it makes a lot more sense to have it percolate up from the bottom than trickle down from the top. That's how you're going to really stimulate some jobs.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. There's currently excess capacity because the demand is down, so giving tax breaks is not going to result in any additional investment or job creation. So you're absolutely right.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Just we've got maybe about 5 minutes left. To continue to talk about the issue of community and reparation as community investment or community investment as reparation. I guess I'm just thinking about as a practical matter. If one assumes that there is the money, so we're going to talk about a significant amount of money, and if one assumes that there's the political will to say that's what we're going to do with it, as a practical matter, how would one do that? Have people been thinking about that?
Well, I'm not sure that there's been a lot of detailed discussion because I think the perception about what the likelihood of actually moving forward on getting consensus around the notion of paying reparations and secondly implementing it has we haven't reached that point yet. But I would say that I think that one of the things that I would do would be to try to create a system of healthcare clinics that provided relatively low cost, or no cost, healthcare in communities that are currently deprived. I would certainly try to put in place daycare centers on a systematic basis that would allow individuals to be able to go to school and to otherwise or to work. I would be trying to put in place programs that would eliminate the digital divide so that children had equal access to information technology and learning how to make use of those technologies. So those are the type of things that I think could be part of a package that was focused on in ways that would make it clear to people who are sort of uneasy about this idea that it wasn't simply a windfall for people who could otherwise do for themselves.
Yeah. There has been some discussion of this in different ways for I don't know, I guess a couple of years at least, that I have been aware of for a couple of years, probably for longer.
Mm-hmm.
What is the possibility, do you think, that we might actually get to the point where we could actually be talking about, in practical terms, what do we do, having already arrived at the other point where we actually decided as a nation that something should be done?
Well, that's a good question. I think that what you're seeing within the African American community is a consensus building across the ideological spectrums about the fact that this represents one of the most likely ways of addressing long-standing issues of inequality. And you're also seeing a lot of attention being paid in African countries to this whole notion, and it's tied to debt relief and other sorts of ways of trying to engage Africa with the global economy in ways that's mutually beneficial. And I think as this process of globalization proceeds and it becomes clear that there's going to be a need to engage everyone in the economic system in meaningful ways, that this will be more acceptable to talk about. And I think we'll eventually get to the point of coming up with some proposals, even if they're only pilot programs that are designed to try to implement some of these ideas.
I know that you have specifically done some thinking about or some looking at South Africa. Are there ways in which our experience, what we're talking about here, and their experience are parallel one another?
Well, we could do a whole show on talking about that. But yes, they are. That if you look at what happened historically, it was very, very similar in a lot of ways. That you had a slavery regime, and then you had sort of a sharecropping type of regime, and then you see both blacks and South African U.S. pulled into the manufacturing system. And the big difference was, of course, that blacks in South Africa were a majority and blacks in the United States were a minority. What we've seen since the transition in South Africa is grappling with these same issues about how do you try and compensate individuals for the oppression that they experienced under apartheid and before. And they've adopted some of the same sort of affirmative action types of approaches that we have. They have what are called black empowerment schemes. But they're also running to the issue of where do you get the funds to be able to do what you need to do. And there's resistance there to the same type that we see to reparations here in the U.S.
Well, at that, I think that we'll stop. We're just about at the end of the time, and we want to say to our guest, James Stewart, thank you very much, Professor Stewart.
For being My here. Pleasure.
Our guest, James Stewart, is a professor of labor studies and industrial relations and African and African-American studies at Penn State University, spending some time here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois.